Blog Talk Radio.
We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, do ordain and establish this
and
Constitution,
so, my fellow Americans,
the United States of America.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do.
This nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and the government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
For peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery. Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death.
From the very heart of the Constitutional Republic of the United States of America, from the soul of the Bellwether State, Missouri Grassroots Radio is live.
And good evening, Missourians, and all of those who are listening in who are not in Missouri. This is Von Carriker. You are listening to Show Me Common Sense on the Missouri Grassroots Radio Network. It is 8.01 p.m. It's May 29. We are coming up on the tail end of National Foster Care Month. I didn't even know we had one. It's in May. It's the entire month of May, and what it's designed to do is bring awareness to the plight of children stuck in the foster system. It's also designed to recognize those people and organizations who've worked to make things better, which is why we are spotlighting tonight our conversation with the most excellent William Bill Simmons, who has done more than his share of suffering as a foster child and who has given more than his share of assistance to abused children once he became an adult. Let's talk about child protection in the United States. It actually went through three distinct historical stages. You know, in colonial times, there was such a thing as child protection. For instance, as early as 1642, Massachusetts law gave magistrates the authority to remove children from homes when the parents didn't properly do something called training them up. If you didn't train up your kids, you could lose them. Of course, in the 1700s, you had indentured servitude where orphans were placed, even if they had parents, because of poverty or social ills or for whatever reason, they were placed either in a home or sold into indentured servitude. They worked for several years for no money, usually 3 to 7. It could be 14 or more. They were supposed to labor for their freedom. They had few, if any, legal rights. They could be sold into servitude to someone else. They weren't allowed to marry. They weren't allowed to leave the property. In fact, they could be punished. They could be whipped as if they were slaves if they violated the rules in the servitude into which they entered. Now, that was a certainly grim part of American history. It happened to adults who immigrated here from other countries, primarily Irish, but it did happen. Now, in 1735, there's an interesting case about a child in the state of Georgia, which I guess wasn't a state then. I'm a little faulty on the history this evening. But in 1735 in the Georgia colony area, a child was removed from a home where she had been sexually abused. You would think that this sort of thing that happened in 1700s and 1800s, the protections that existed, such as they were only for white children, but this is not true. Amos Broad and his wife in New York were convicted in 1809. They committed some horrific abuse against a slave woman and her 3-year-old child, a slave they owned, slaves they owned. But even in the 1800s, there were laws that prevented people from acting like animals, and the Broads were convicted under those laws. Now, criminal prosecution was pursued, and people were convicted throughout the 1800s. For instance, in Illinois, a father was prosecuted for keeping his blind son in a cellar in the middle of winter. And the Supreme Court told them, because it went all the way to the Illinois Supreme Court, they said, you don't get to raise your kids any way you want. There are standards. Parental authority is subject to things called reason and humanity. Perhaps you've heard of them. And the law will punish you for wanton and needless cruelty towards a child. So prior to 1875, not only could parents be punished for abusing children, even if they weren't their own, but if you were a drunkard, a criminal, or otherwise connected to some sort of vice, your children could be removed. If your children were abused, neglected, not being educated, not being parented, or generally being exposed to something called an idle and dissolute life, they could be removed. In other words, parents could lose their children if they were raising them to be bums. And it was largely a power that was prescribed by law. It wasn't all-encompassing or uniformly practiced, but it did exist. And after that, we'll take a brief break, and we will come back with Bill Simmons. We're going to discuss a little bit more about child protective history. We're going to talk about the infamous Mary Ellen Wilson case, and we're going to take your calls. If you want to call and join the discussion, feel free to do so. It's 347-677-1835. When we get back, Bill Simmons is going to be our guest here at Show Me Common Sense on the Missouri Grassroots Network.
Okay, Missouri Patriots, I don't have to remind you that our ancestors fought and died for our right to exercise our voices and shape government in the interests of the people. And yet, in most elections, less than 20% of the population bothers to vote. Gas prices are outrageous, the economy is a disaster, and we are being regulated to death. Bad government and weak leadership are destroying the American way of life on a national and state level, and it's time to send a message to Washington, D.C. and Jefferson City and tell them we have had enough. If you're not registered to vote, the deadline to be eligible to vote in the August primary is July 11th and October 10th for the general election in November. The Patriot Revolution begins in 2012, and it happens at the polls. Vote in the August primary and the November general election, and bring a friend. The Constitutional Republic depends on it. I've got a feeling that the
tide is turning. Is life so dear, or peace so sweet, as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God! I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death.
Hello, welcome. This is May 29th. I am Von Carriker. You are listening to Show Me Common Sense on the Missouri Grassroots Network. And I am here with the wonderful, the awesome, the amazing, the incredible. Bill, are you listening?
Yeah, I'm listening. My head is swelling as you speak.
The most impressive, William Bill Simmons. Air applause. Bill, how are you, dear?
I am doing good. How are you this evening, Von?
I'm doing great. Did you know I was going to do that to you?
No, I had no idea, but I don't know that I'll be able to walk upstairs because my head's too big now.
Well, you tell your wife, Amanda, that it's all my fault and that they'll have to get a special sling for your head from now on, okay?
All righty. Sounds good.
Now, Bill, before you came on, I was talking a little bit with the listeners about the history of foster care. I'm going to ask you, you're a child of the foster care system. You're a literate man. You read quite a bit. Have you ever heard of Mary Ellen Wilson?
Yes, I've heard of it. I haven't read much about it, but I'm a little familiar with it.
Okay. For the listeners, I'm just going to enlighten them a little bit. Mary Ellen, 9 years old, her father died in the Civil War. Her mother abandoned her. She ended up living in a place called Hell's Kitchen in New York. And back then, when she moved to Hell's Kitchen, it earned that name and then some. Now, Mary Ellen suffered horrific abuse. I think the favorite weapon of choice was a rawhide whip, and starvation was the second favorite weapon of choice. If you go on Wikipedia and you look for her, you will see pictures of what she looked like at that time. Now, Bill, the interesting thing about that is that she was spotted by this missionary who had been brought in to help this girl. This missionary, her name was Etta, went to the police, and the police didn't do anything. They refused. And then she went to the children's charities, and they couldn't intervene. This wasn't their kid. There was no juvenile court and no child protective agency. So they ended up going to the founder of the ASPCA. You know what that is, don't you, Bill?
Yes, ma'am.
The American Society for the Prevention of
Cruelty to Animals.
Absolutely. There were no laws on the books to protect children, but there were for animals. And so the ASPCA attorney Jerry rigged a legal suit and was able to spring Mary Ellen from those people. And eventually she went to live with the missionary's family. She was raised as the daughter of one of the sisters. She married a man, had children of her own, adopted some. Some of her kids went on to college, and she died at the ripe old age of 92. So because of Etta and because of Mary Ellen, the first Society to Prevent Cruelty to Children was founded in New York City. And then other states got hold of that idea. And then we have the system that we have today, which is largely federal. Now, Bill, you
Yes, ma'am.
Were raised in the foster system, were you not?
Yes, I was.
Okay. Was it something that started early in your life?
Yes, I went into foster care when I was about 6 years old, and I stayed in foster care until I was 18, and I bounced around to 32 different foster homes and 4 group homes and detention centers. The last 7 years that I was in foster care, I was with one family, the Slinkards here in Farmington where I live. And so those first, you know, that 31 foster homes and 4 group homes and detention centers, that was all in the first 5 years I was in care.
And were you an only child?
No, I was not an only child. I have 6 brothers and sisters biologically.
Now, when you went into the foster care system, did you go in with all your brothers and sisters?
Yes, all but my 2 youngest sisters. My 2 older sisters, my younger brother, and I all went into foster care, and then my 2 younger sisters stayed with my mom.
Okay. Now, you don't have to answer these questions, Bill, because I know sometimes these can get tough, and I do ask every once in a while a question that makes young people uncomfortable. But why was it that you ended up in the system? If you can tell me, if you can't, just say you're not going to talk about it. That's fine.
I ended up in the system basically due to child abuse and neglect, which was the same story for my brothers and sisters. My mother had my oldest sister while she was still a teenager. And so, you know, it was one of those things when a teenager has kids, they're not prepared mentally, number one, to deal with the stresses that kids bring along. And I think that was the biggest causation factor in why we ended up in foster care from abuse and neglect is basically my mother just didn't know how to care for us.
Okay. What about your father?
My father was pretty much absent from my entire childhood except for about three years that I lived with him in Alabama. And to be quite honest with you, there was some child abuse and stuff that happened, you know, before I went into care, and then I went down with my dad there in Alabama. And the 3 years that I spent in Alabama, I refer to those 3 years as the 3 years in the belly of the beast. A very, very, very sadistic man. You know, one of the things that if you know, you know, which you know this, you and I have talked about it, but anybody that knows me knows I have a love-hate relationship with thunderstorms.
Yes.
I love to stand outside and watch a thunderstorm, stand in the garage or something, but I hate to be rained on. It just drives me insane to have rain on me. And that stems from that 3 years I spent with my father in Alabama. He didn't think it was a manly thing for a kid to be afraid of a thunderstorm, for a male child to be afraid of a thunderstorm. And so when it would storm, he would lock me outside in the storm. And the way the house sat on the side of the mountain that we lived on, you know, the front porch was like 8 foot off the ground on stilts, you know, and I would go under the front porch and I could sit under there. And when I was out there, I knew that number one, I wasn't going to get beat on, but I hated being rained on. So I have that love-hate relationship with a thunderstorm now that I think that's where it goes back to. I mean, that's the only thing I can attribute that to.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're listening to Bill Simmons talk about his experiences as an abused child and a foster child. If you want to call and talk to him yourself, the number is 347-677-1835. Bill, you have a love-hate relationship with rain. Do you have a love-hate relationship with your biological father?
I don't know him to say whether I love him. I don't know this, you know, other than what I know about him to say that I hate him. You know, everything that I have is from a childhood point of view, and from that point of view, you know, it's one of those things. I, for me, the best thing, and I think this is for anybody that's dealt with this, if you don't learn to forgive those people, this will eat you up. It will absolutely ruin the rest of your life. So for me, I just forgave him and moved on. So as far as a love or a hate, I really have no feeling one way or the other toward the man.
Now, how old were you when you forgave?
Oh, that's a hard question to answer. Really, honestly.
Still working on it?
Well, no, I've absolutely forgiven him, and I think what it, and you know, I'm one of those guys that have a strong relationship with Jesus Christ. I'm a Christian. I don't run away from that or hide from it. And, you know, when Jesus Christ comes to you and he shows you everything that he died for and forgave you for, it's really hard to not forgive somebody else for the things they've done.
Okay. Now, do you have a relationship at all with your mother?
Yeah, matter of fact, my mother is actually one of my friends on Facebook, and you know, as far as holding anything against her for what happened when we were kids, I don't. I think, you know, honestly, I think as far as what she was doing, is she was doing the best she could with what she knew, and it was just bad. So I don't really hold anything against her. I'm very protective of my two boys, you know, because I know what happened to me, and I'm as far as my boys, they haven't met her. They haven't talked to her or anything of that nature. As far as my two boys are concerned, their grandma and grandpa are the slinkers that raised me for the last 7 years I was in foster care.
And we're going to actually talk some more about Bruce and Clara Slinkard as we get through your story, because that is actually pretty amazing. I want to touch on something that you mentioned earlier. You have been in 32 foster homes?
Yes, ma'am. And 4 group homes and 2 detention centers.
Why so many foster homes? Do you know?
I know a big part of it was I didn't. It was one of those things when you go through foster care and you go through what I did, you know, and you watch the kids around you and they're not having those problems, you automatically start to, even as a kid, you start to look at those things and you start analyzing, why is this happening to me? And the only thing I could come up with is I was doing something wrong. And so instead of allowing somebody to get close enough to me to hurt me again, it wasn't so much that I was going to hurt anybody. I pushed people away so that they wouldn't hurt me. And I took on a very hardcore attitude, and I was a very, I didn't trust anybody. So I think a big part of the reason I bounced around a lot was that I absolutely did not trust anyone. The other part of that is, you know, people, when they get into foster care, they have this grand illusion that they're going to save the world or that they're going to, you know, save some kid's life. And does it happen once in a while? Yeah. But I think there's a little bit of self-delusionment going on there when people get into the foster care system that they have to understand you're not going to be, you know, somebody saving grace all the time. And
yeah,
I think that's probably where a lot of my moves came from, is people just realized, you know what, this is not for me. This is foster care. This is not what I signed up for.
You know, I signed up for foster care when I lived in Ohio, and I went through months and months of training. And one of the things that the instructor told me and everyone else in the class is that all abused children love their parents, even if they're being abused. They just want that abuse to stop.
Right.
At the time you went to foster care, do you think that was the truth?
Absolutely. I absolutely loved my mother. I was probably with Bruce and Clara for 3.5 or 4 years before I really let go of any hope I ever had of being reunited with my mother. I mean, I just, at that point, I came to the realization that's just not going to happen. But up until that point, I love my mother, and I was hoping for a reunion. I hope it would, you know, work out, and I'd get back with her at some point.
Okay. Why do you think that you didn't end up getting back with her in your home?
Basically because, a lot of people are, you know, ask the question, how could you just walk away from your mom? And, my standard answer to that is, you have to understand this. Well, I went into foster care we had weekly visits up with my mother. And my foster parents would take me to the DFS office for those weekly visits. And week after week, month after month, my mother wouldn't show up. So it wasn't me that walked away. It seemed more to me like my mother had walked away than me walking away.
Now, was it the same situation for your brothers and sisters?
Yes. Yeah, pretty much, you know, anybody that was supposed to have visits, they just didn't happen.
Now, Bill, how old were you, and I'm assuming here, so tell me if I'm incorrect, how old were you in the foster care system when you were separated from your other siblings in foster care?
My youngest brother and I stayed together for about the first year and a half we were in care. And my two older sisters, they tried to keep them together, and they tried to keep me and my younger brother together. If you know anything about me and my younger brother Keith at that time, it was like Mike Tyson meets Muhammad Ali in the ring about 90% of the time, because we grew up fighting, and that's the only way we knew to solve a problem. So if I get mad at him, it was, you know, gloves off, and if he got mad at me, it was gloves off. And that's how we solve problems. And, you know, a lot of families are not set up to deal with two boys that are, you know, 7 and 8 years old that are blacking each other's eye and bloodying each other's nose and just beating the crap out of each other all the time.
Well, that's true. You know, I talked to you about my nephews, and I think the worst thing they ever did was set up a blockade on my street and charge all the other little kids $5 to get home. And I tell you, I thought, every time I looked at them, I thought, if only you used your powers for good.
they had entrepreneurial ability. They were just going about it the wrong way.
They had ability. Yes, this is true. I will not deny that they had ability. And, of course, like most boys, they fought like cats and dogs, I got to tell you. I think they loved each other, though. It seems to me from their earliest years that they took care of each other, even when their mother couldn't take care of them.
Absolutely. Me and Keith, to this day, I mean, there's been some things that have happened between me and Keith, even in our adult life that, you know, we don't talk about. But even to this day, I mean, Keith and I have very much a, I can go after this guy, but everybody else better leave him alone mentality.
Okay, I understand that. Now, let me ask you something. Do you have the same relationship with your sisters?
One of my sisters from the abuse, she has some brain damage, and she's blind in both eyes. She was very severely abused as a child. And
by your parents?
By my parents. And she, you know, she lives in a nursing home, and so she just moved here close to me about a year and a half or 2 years ago. So I've been spending a lot of time with her and just rebuilding and reconnecting with her and our relationship and everything. And, you know, it's one of those things. I know as far as my family, I'm probably the only one with the financial ability and that kind of thing to take care of her. So I've kind of taken on that responsibility as her brother to, you know, make sure she's getting the care she needs and that kind of thing, and just trying to take care of her as best I can here locally.
That's really impressive. That really is. That's quite an honorable thing. You're talking with me, Von Carriker, at Show Me Common Sense on the Missouri Grassroots Radio Network. 347-677-1835 is the phone number. Bill, you've talked about your baby brother. You've talked about one sister. You have more siblings than that.
Yes.
What's your relationship like with them?
Okay, my oldest sister is the one that's here local that has a lot of the brain damage and stuff from the abuse. My next sister that's just older than me, between me and this oldest sister, when I was 13, actually when I was living with Bruce and Clara, Ruby, she died in a house fire in Cape Girardeau while me and Keith were in foster care, and so I really never did get a chance to get to know her. So of the four that went into foster care, that there's only three of us left. That's my oldest sister, my younger brother, and me. My two younger sisters, one, Barbara. I'm trying to rebuild some relationships with BJ. Her name's Barbara Jean, so we just all call her BJ. I'm really trying to rebuild some relationships with BJ. She's got her feet on solid ground, and she's doing really good. My other sister, that's BJ's the youngest of the six. Mary is the next to the youngest. She's between Keith and BJ. And Mary, I've tried to work with her. I've tried to, you know, rebuild bridges with her and that kind of thing. And, you know, I'm not saying it would never happen again, but, you know, in my efforts to try and help her, a lot of bridges were burned. And so I'm dealing with some trust issues as far as that sibling. But other than that, I mean, it's, you know, I'm here in the last few years, I've been lucky enough to reconnect with some of my siblings and start rebuilding some relationships and stuff like that. I mean, it's a work in progress.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you. I think you said that Mary and BJ were not in the system at all. Is that correct?
Correct.
Now, do you think that maybe there's some guilt there that comes into play or some resentment on your part, maybe guilt on their part that might be interfering with the relationship in some way?
Well, I think a big part of the issue with me and Mary is a lot of the abuse that me and Keith and Michelle and Ruby experienced was at the hands of Mary and BJ's biological father. And,
okay.
You know, it's one of those things, Mary dearly loves her dad, and I would never tell her not to. I mean, that's absolutely, it's her father, and I would never tell her not to. But I do think there's some tension there where that's where a lot of the abuse happened, and Mary doesn't want to, I don't think she wants to take that or admit that. BJ, I don't know, I don't know where BJ stands on that whole thing. We haven't really talked about it, but I know BJ and I have been able to really start working on our relationship and rebuilding it. And that relationship looks very hopeful and promising. I'm sure that's something we'll talk about at some point, but I just haven't had a chance to talk to BJ about that. But I think that's where a lot of the, I guess you'd say, the tension between me and Mary came in, was that's where a lot of that abuse happened. And, you know, that was her dad, and she dearly loved him. And you know, if somebody came to me and told me that my dad, Bruce, had done something like that, I wouldn't want to believe it. I wouldn't believe it. So I can totally see where she's coming from on that. But I think that's where a lot of that tension is.
Well, I understand. I can see that. Now, Bill, if you don't mind, I'm really, really fascinated by this conversation. I hope you can stay with me. I'm wanting to take a little break here, and then we're going to talk about the wonderful, the remarkable, the stupendous, the amazing Bruce and Clara Slinkard. If you think you've got a big head, you just hold on. All right? Do you mind sticking around, talking to me after the break?
Yes, absolutely.
You're listening to Von Carriker? Absolutely. You're listening to Von Carriker. I'm here with Bill Simmons on the Missouri Grassroots Radio Network, and this is Show Me Common Sense. We're going to take a break and come right back.
Jobs, taxes, traditional family values, education, protecting the unborn, Second Amendment, tort reform. These are the issues facing Missourians today. Hi, I'm Terry Barner. As your next state senator, I will continue to work to change government by preserving our liberties, reining in wasteful spending, and making the state of Missouri responsive to its citizens. I am a pro-life constitutionalist who believes our state and federal constitution are there for our protection from overreaching government. I firmly believe that only by ignoring those documents has the government at all levels been able to trample on the liberty of its people. I would appreciate your vote this August 7th. I'm Terry Barner, and I approve this message.
And the government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
Hello, Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Von Carriker with Show Me Common Sense, and we are on the air with Bill Simmons. I give Bill a lot of compliments because Bill's story is so remarkable, and as I think I said in our promos, he's come through it all with his sense of humor and his dignity and his basic decency intact. And I think one of the reasons for that, Bill, may lie with Bruce and Clara Slinkard. Now, they are your last foster parents. Foster parents set number 32, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. How old were you when you went to live with them?
I was 8 years old.
Okay, and you lived with them for what, seven years?
No, I'm sorry. I came to Farmington when I was 8 years old in the Farmington Children's Home, and then I went to live with Bruce and Claire when I was 11.
Okay. And you lived with them until you were 18?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Now, Bruce doesn't know we're talking about him on the radio tonight, does he?
No.
You told me, and we talked, I think, last week or so, you told me that Bruce Slinkard did this remarkable thing for you that changed your life, and he doesn't even remember this. Why don't you tell us about it?
Well, I remember it till the day I die, and it's like it happened yesterday. It's still fresh in my mind. We were out cutting wood one day, and, you know, we lived outside of town, so that was kind of one of the things you did every summer is you cut wood for the winter and that kind of stuff. And he shut the saw off, and he was sharpening the chain on it and that kind of thing, putting barrel on it and that kind of stuff. And I was splitting wood with an old splitting wall we had out there, because that's how we rolled back then. We didn't have these fancy wood splitters they have today. If you ever look at my shoulders, that's why I got shoulders. That's because I was splitting wood when I was a kid. Bruce shut this off and everything, and he sat down and he pulled up a log there next to him, and he said, "Come over here and sit down, son." And I thought, well, here it comes. I don't know what it did, but I'm about to find out. And I went over and sat down, and he said, "Son, I'm not going to candy coat it for you. You've had a crappy life, and nobody's going to argue with you that you've had a crappy childhood." And he said, "That's not what this world is concerned about. What this world is concerned about is that you become a productive citizen. And it's my job as your father to keep my foot in your ass until that happens." And he did. And I remember that conversation like it happened yesterday.
Now, let me ask you something, Bill. Was that the first time any one of your 32 sets of foster parents ever had that conversation with you?
Yes. Hands down, that was the first time anybody had ever even indicated that they gave a crap about my future.
So the previous foster families were not good ones?
No. I had one foster family that was pretty good to me, which was the Spartans down in Gordonville. And Lisa and Greg were just amazing foster parents, and I thank God for them every day. I think the reason that one ended the way, why I was taken out of that home is I think it was one of those things, they were just getting ready. Well, matter of fact, Garrett, I think, had just been born, and he was a newborn, and that's, I still talk to Garrett. Matter of fact, I talked to Garrett this morning. Garrett and Casey Joel, I consider them my brother and sister, and they're from the Spartan family, and Lisa and Greg, they're just amazing people. But I think with a newborn in the house and me dealing with the issues I was dealing with, it was too much to handle at one time, and I totally respect that. And I absolutely love Lisa and Greg to death. I would never say anything bad about that family at all. But as far as any of my other foster families besides that one, no.
Wow. And which number were they? They weren't number 31, right?
No. They were probably 12, 13, 14, somewhere in there.
Amazing.
They got me when I was probably 7 much more than 7 when they got me.
Bill, that's amazing. That is absolutely amazing. I I'm stunned. 32 sets of foster parents, and two out of the 32 sets actually had a shred of decency. It makes me really hurt inside for the kids who weren't as lucky as you were.
Yeah. Yeah, some of the stories that, and just coming from that background, I get to talk to foster parents and foster kids, you know, on probably more occasions than most folks, and some of the stories that I've heard are just, they're heart-wrenching, because the kids are brought out of a situation where they are supposed to be being brought into a situation of protection, and it's just not happening sometimes. I mean, more times than you think, a child is brought out of a situation that's bad and put in a situation that may be even worse.
That's just mind-boggling. Now, let me ask you something. Being one of the fortunate children, did you have a plan for what you were going to do when you turned 18 and aged out of the system?
At what point?
Yeah. Did you? I'm imagining that your plan at age 6 was a little different from your plan at age 12 and a little different from your plan when Bruce Flinker gave you the talk that changed your life. Am I correct?
Yes, absolutely. At 12, my goal was to not make it past 18.
That was your goal?
That was my goal. I was just going to live hard and die young. That was my goal.
Talking about setting the bar low.
If you talk to Bruce and Claire, they would tell you that's absolutely true.
Oh, man. And then it was the talk with Bruce, the life-changing talk. Did that change your goal at that point from live hard and die young to maybe something like live not as hard and die at a relatively decent age?
That one conversation, I don't know that I've ever told him this. That conversation that day, while we were out there cutting wood and getting ready for, I can tell you what he was wearing that day. But I can tell you that conversation right there changed my goal from live hard, die young before I turn 18. That changed my entire outlook on life, that one conversation. And it wasn't one of those things that just changed instantly, but over the next 24 hours, my entire outlook on life changed.
In 24 hours?
In 24 hours.
Now, how did that happen? What was the process in your head?
You get into that conversation where someone actually shows an interest in more than just, you know, getting a check for you living in their house, where they actually make the point to tell you that I'm going to push you as hard as I can push you to turn you into something productive. That changed my whole outlook on where I wanted to be, because I went from wanting to live hard and die young. I actually had a man that I looked up to at that point. And my goal went from live hard and die young to get as close to being Bruce Linker as I possibly can.
Oh, that brings me to a wonderful point here. You know, the women in my office, they know you and they love you. You know, we've worked some cases together, and they know you as Silverback.
Yes,
which
ma'am.
Is why we call, yeah, and that's why we call your oldest son Babyback. And apologize,
yeah.
I offer my apologies to your wife. I know she hates that name. It's just a natural progression. tell the audience why you have the name Silverback.
Well, do you want the biker explanation, or do you want how that name actually came to be?
Yes, both.
Okay. Well, I worked for the Sheriff's Department here in San Francisco County, and our uniform was a gray T-shirt and black BDU pants. And I was at work one day, and I was getting an inmate out of the jail that was bonding out. And one of the bail bondsmen, Tim Tucker, was there bonding this person out. And Tim looked at me as I come down the hall. He had this funny grin on his face. And I brought the guy up, and I set him down. And Tim said, you know, you walking down that hall with those little short legs and those long arms and that silver shirt on, you look like a silverback ape coming down that hall. And that name just stuck. When I got into riding with Bikers Against Child Abuse, my name was Silverback. And anybody that's known me for any length of time, you know, they know my nickname, Silverback.
Oh, my gosh. I love that story. Now, you're listening to Bill Simmons on Missouri Grassroots Radio Network. This is Show Me Common Sense. The number is 347-677-1835. Bill, tell us about Bikers Against Child Abuse.
Bikers Against Child Abuse, honestly, it's an excellent organization. I had a little bit of a falling out with the leadership, but that does not negate the awesomeness of Bikers Against Child Abuse. This is a group of guys. You know, they all own motorcycles. They're all they have the biker persona nailed. I mean, leather vests, and they're big, burly, tattooed. They are bikers to the core. And the thing they will not stand for is child abuse. That is their one goal, is to protect kids from child abuse. And if a kid's been abused, you can contact Bikers Against Child Abuse through their website, bikausa.com. They will verify that there's an open case going in the court system involving that kid. And they will work with the court system, DFS, whoever they have to work with, to get involved with that kid. And they will actually escort that kid to court. So when that kid goes in and testifies against this person that has molested them or has beaten them or whatever, these bikers are sitting in the courtroom. And the one thing we always told kids was, you don't worry about telling your story to that guy sitting over there. You tell me. I'm sitting in that courtroom, you look at me, and you tell me your story. And those kids have a new sense of empowerment. And they will sit there on that stand, and they will tell every detail of what happened to them at the hands of this other person, because they're not afraid anymore. They've got a family of bikers around them that will protect them and will die for them if necessary.
And Bikers Against Child Abuse members have actually camped out on the yards of children who've suffered some abuse and have to go to court and talk about it. Is that correct? And why
is
that?
When I was with BACA, we had a couple of cases where abuse had occurred, but this person had not been arrested. There was a warrant out for their arrest, but they hadn't been arrested yet. And the kids were having trouble sleeping and that kind of thing. So what we did is we set up what was called a level 2 intervention through BACA. And we would camp out outside this kid. We'd find out from mom and dad, which room is this kid's room? Which window is theirs? And we would camp out outside that house. And that kid could look out that window and know that nobody was coming through that line of bikers. Those boys were there, and there was nothing coming in that house. And they would get the first good night of sleep that they may have gotten in 2 or 3 weeks. And it's really, if you're in BACA, you know, to see a 6'10" biker with tattoos stand out there and have his heart break knowing that there's a kid that's afraid in that house because of some jerk that's out there that's beat on him. It's a powerful thing to be a part of.
That is amazing. We've worked together. I've had some cases with some really nasty stuff, and BACA has been a lifesaver. You actually have fans among my former clients. They still love you. Their mothers wish you were single. You are the most popular person in families with abused children with whom I've dealt, and I'm a big fan of BACA, and I highly recommend it. BACAUSA.org, BACAUSA.org. Now, you've received some awards for your work with foster children and abused children. Is that correct?
Yes, I've received a couple.
And again, your head is already large. Let's just swell it just a second more. Well, who's recognized your work besides me and every woman in my office?
I've been recognized by the Farmington School District as a Heartland Hero. And that was for my work
well
with
learned.
The kids at the Farmington Children's Home through the Youth for Christ program there. And then,
weren't you commended by the state at some point?
I've actually, through Farmington Children's Home and the Presbyterian Children's Organization, I've actually been all over the state of Missouri. I've done several guest speaking engagements. And one of those was in Jeff City, and a lot of the people that heard that talk were members of the Missouri House and the Missouri Senate. So I've had some pretty – I was honored to be there as a guest speaker among, you know, such esteemed individuals in the community. So, yeah, there's – I mean, as part of BACA, the Southeast Missouri chapter here, we got we actually got a commendation from the Missouri State House of Representatives for our work with abused kids.
Well, indeed. I think you deserved it. Let me ask you something, Bill. Because you have inside experience, what advice would you offer to any adult who's considering becoming a foster parent?
I'd say number one, pray about it earnestly and talk to God and make sure that's where He wants you to go. Two, don't go into it with the idea that you're going to be a hero. Go into it with the idea that I'm going to do everything I can to help a kid. And there's a difference. going into it, and I think that's why Bruce and Claire were so successful with me. They weren't trying to pull off a miracle. They were just trying to help a kid. And I think that's what, if you're going to be a foster parent, go into it with that in mind, that you're not going to pull off a miracle every day. But the little things you do every day that make a little bit of difference, those are miracles in and of themselves.
Now, I can agree with that. I'll tell you what, my nephews, as you know, lived with me for 10 years. And I'll tell you what, 10 seemed like 20. But I remember I loved them even when they were at their most frustrating. I never wanted to give them back, but that wasn't in my control. But the one thing that was clear to me, and it was made clear to me by everybody, even the boys, was that they were not mine. And, you know, I know that there are foster parents who get the sense of, I am better than the bio parents. Just let me take over. You all step back, and I've got this. What's your thought on that?
Well, in a lot of cases, they're probably right. You know, it's one of those things, if you have a foster parent that is like that, if they're just like, just let me take over, that's usually a foster parent that's not in it for money or anything else. They're in it to help a kid. You know, what is heartbreaking for any adult is, and this is one of the reasons Amanda and I have talked about it, that we're not going to pursue being foster parents, is the possibility that we're going to have to give a kid back. That maybe giving them back into a situation that we know something's going to happen again. What I would say to that is the court system is there for a reason. If the court makes that decision, that's a decision we're all going to have to live with. Is it hard? Yes. Can you change it? No.
Bill Simmons with the Missouri Grassroots Network on Show Me Common Sense. We're going to take a very short break, and when we get back, we're going to talk a little bit about the Children's Division and the agencies and their goals and policies. Bill, can you stick around for that?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, this is wonderful. If you want to call in and join us, it's 347-677-1835. This is the Missouri Grassroots Network.
Hey, free market capitalist Missouri business owners, show Missouri and the rest of the country what hardworking, successful entrepreneurship looks like by advertising your business on Missouri Grassroots Radio. Get your message out to liberty-loving citizens who want to support liberty-loving capitalists. Target this unique and widespread market with your business's unique and valuable products and services. Contact us at info@missourigrassrootscoalition.org for details.
Show
beer for peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery. Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death.
Welcome back. This is Von Karaker on Show Me Common Sense on the Missouri Grassroots Radio Network. If you want to talk to us, it's 347-677-1835. I hardly want to talk myself. I'm really, really enjoying listening to Bill Simmons talk to me about the foster child experience, his family's experiences, the life-changing event that his foster father doesn't even know about, probably, and what he's done with himself since. Bill.
Yes, ma'am.
Reunification. I wanted to ask, this is a question probably I want to ask every foster parent, what kind of relationship, if any, do your foster parents, number 32, couple number 32, have with your biological mother?
None.
Have they ever met?
Relationship. I think they met at Ruby's funeral briefly. When Ruby died when I was in foster care, but other than that, I'm not sure they've ever met.
That's amazing. Now, Bill, you know, after the federal government began to develop an interest in child welfare, they created a federal agency to assist in the removal of children from the home, government-sponsored child protection, even though states had started in the early 1800s. Now, I think it was 1935, that the Social Security Act authorized money to create the first child welfare service funded through the federal government. Now, you know what happens when the federal government starts creating agencies? They just get bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
I mean, am I lying?
No. You're
okay.
Spot on. Bigger government's never the answer.
Yeah, and eventually the feds began to demand that states provide matching funds if they wanted to receive any federal money for child welfare services. And then social service agencies started getting ridiculous. I mean, I recall in Louisiana, 23,000 kids were kicked off welfare in 1960 because their moms didn't have husbands. And what happened was the federal government had to develop the Fleming Rule. Do you recall this?
Yes.
There was a time when if you were on welfare, for whatever reason, if your husband left or your parents were gone and you were on welfare, social services would come into your home and they would pass judgment on you and you had to dance to their tune. Now, the Fleming Rule said, we're not going to do that anymore. Don't ignore these kids and their financial needs because you think their home life is unsuitable. And they're talking to the state agencies. They said, if you think there's a problem in the home, either make the home suitable or remove the child to a suitable placement. And no matter which one you do, you give that child financial support. Now, how did the Fleming Rule, as I just explained it, come into play with you as a foster child in the system? Was reunification, making your mother's home suitable for you to live in, was that ever on the board or on the table?
They actually tried it twice. They tried reunification twice. It lasted about 2 weeks or a month, and that was it. I mean, you'd be right back in foster care. They came into the home and said the home is unfit for children. There's abuse and neglect. There's no water. There's no lights. And they would remove us. And then my mother and they would sing and dance to the tune. Kids would come back and they'd go right back to where they were, right back to the way it was before. There was no real change.
Do you think that your mom... And this may be a question you can't answer. Do you think your mom worked hard enough to get you back?
To me, if it was my child that was in foster care, there is nothing. And I will tell you now, there is absolutely nothing on this earth you can name that I would not do if my child was in foster care to get my kid back home. Nothing.
Now,
if it meant, one of the things was my mother was supposed to make these weekly visits there at DFS. Well, if it were me, I don't care if I had to walk 30 miles in a burning heat with no water or anything, I would make that visit. I would be there for that visit. You know, and well, I couldn't get a ride or a thousand other excuses why. But to me, if my child's in foster care, there's nothing I'm not going to do to make that happen. So do I think my mother could have done something more? Yes.
Okay. Let me ask you something. I think there might be, and you feel free to disagree with me, Bill. Bill Simmons on the Missouri Grassroots Radio Network here. Feel free to disagree with me. Let's say you never graduated high school. You had your first child at 14. You can't read. You barely count. You have no transportation. You've got 5, 6, 7 kids, and they are taken from you.
Mm-hmm.
You're told, one, that you need to go take parenting classes. Two, you need to go get a job. Three, you need to make every one of these two-hour meetings, even if they're 30, 40 miles away. Four, you need to put your kids in this school, take them to this doctor, and put them maybe in this church. Five, do anything else, including drug tests at will, random drug tests, whatever the children's division asks you to do. And six, generally, no complaining, because complaining means that you are farther away from getting your children back than you were at the beginning. How would those play into it? Because I'm actually citing things that were actual conditions and cases I've had with actual clients who were in that situation. Does that make a difference in your opinion?
When you make a demand on a parent, you should make that demand realistic. You know, go get a job, go do this, go do that. Well, it's fine. I can go to all the parenting classes you want me to go to, but if I don't know how to read, it's not going to do me any freaking good.
And you're supposed to pay for them yourself.
Yeah, if I'm supposed to, how am I supposed to get a job if I, you know, if I can't read or write? You know, you got to deal with it. And here's the thing: what the system does now is it treats symptoms. It doesn't treat the problem. It doesn't treat
the problem?
Source. The problem is very simply: we have people that are having kids that are. It's a deep issue. I don't know if we can cover it in 20 minutes. Because
we only have about two.
There is a fundamental breakdown in the family unit. And the fundamental breakdown in the family unit is we have people that are having kids outside of marriage, outside of wedlock, kids that are not prepared for the world, and then those kids grow up not prepared for the world. And then they have kids that are not prepared for the world. And the problem just keeps accentuating itself as you go down the line. It just keeps adding to itself. The source has to be met. Education is probably 90% of the problem, but that's not the whole problem. There's a breakdown in the family unit morality.
Well, Bill, I have to say, I think you maybe nailed it. I don't know how we're going to fix that problem. We're not going to fix it in 15 seconds. I want to thank you, Bill Simmons, for coming on the show. I appreciate everything you've said today. It's been awesome.
I love having the opportunity to sit and chat with you, and maybe we need to do a part two and part three.
Absolutely, we will. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Show Me Common Sense on the Missouri Grassroots Network. See you next week.
Missouri Grassroots Radio is brought to you by the Missouri Grassroots Coalition, a cooperative of independent Missouri groups whose aim is to restore constitutional government. Visit us at MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org, check out our Facebook page, and follow us on Twitter. You can contact us anytime at info@MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org. God bless and keep you till next time we meet.